In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Yeah, time to talk movies. Alan Adams from The Main Edge joins us on this Monday afternoon. Hello there, Al.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Doing very well, thank you. Happy President's Day, Washington's birthday, whatever we're calling today. Hope that's going well.
Well, I'm calling it nothing. Thanks for nothing, Millard Fillmore.
Yeah, damn right. He screwed it up for everybody. And I hope you had a nice Valentine's Day with your bride yesterday.
I did. We actually, because Sunday tends to be a pretty busy day for me in terms of work, we actually celebrated on Saturday night. So we just we had a quiet night. I made dinner. She made dessert. We settled in and watched a movie actually on Saturday night, and just had a lovely evening. Yesterday was a little more low key, but you know, we got our heart shaped boxes of chocolates and various Valentine's gifts in there as well. So yeah, no, it was a good weekend.
Nice, very nice. Well, you saw some movies. Let's talk about what you got a chance to check out.
I did actually. I've actually got quite a list here because I was lucky enough to gain access to a couple of advanced screeners. And so, I've got a list of five here, Rich.
Oh, my stars.
We don't need to get all to all of them, at least not in depth. But there are a couple that I think certainly warrant mention, but, you know, that's not going to, we don't need to go too far into it. We'll start with the one documentary in the mix. It's a film called, it's called Ruth. Justice Ginsburg in her own words, and it's from the documentarian Frieda Lee Mock, and yeah, it's exactly what it says it is. It's a documentary about the life and work of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. All of it, the majority of it, derived from archival audio and video recordings, sort of repurposed to sort of tell the story of her. Primarily her working life. Like, there's a little bit of stuff about her, you know, her childhood and her her personal life, her husband Martin Ginsburg, and all that. But it's mostly about her time working with the law, whether that's her time teaching at Rutgers Law School or her litigation, the cases she brought to before the Supreme Court as a lawyer, and then of course her time on the Supreme Court bench as well. Like, I don't need to tell people that the story of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Like, if you know, and if you don't, well, you know, start reading books, because this is an important person. But yeah, it's a fine movie. The biggest issue is it's one of those movies that sort of fell through the cracks distribution wise. And so this movie was completed in 2019, and that's when it was making the sort of festival circuit. And so certain very important aspects up to and, probably most importantly, Justice Ginsburg's passing aren't really addressed in the body of the film. And so there is that feeling of it being a little bit dated. But at the same time, it's really an interesting sort of journey. And again, you get to hear all of it play out in her words, as opposed to the words of others, which I think is pretty interesting.
I like the sound of that. Excellent. All right, what else have you got?
I actually have a couple of sort of young person, like I've got like three love stories, which is, it's funny because with Valentine's Day being yesterday, three different sort of love stories that play out in various ways in the movies that we have. We'll start with this one. It's a little indie film called Young Hearts. And so often, like, these sorts of, like, teen romances are, it's not enough to just have, a teen romance. It's got to be, like, oh, like, we're in a post-apocalyptic future, or somebody has some horrifying wasting disease, or this, or that, or the other thing. And so, like, there's just this temptation to add all these variables to the equation. And so when you get a story that's that doesn't have any of that stuff. That's just a very sweet, simple story of young love. It almost it feels almost daring because it's so simple, and that's what you have here. It's co-directed by a brother-sister team, Sarah and Zachary Sherman. And Sarah Sherman wrote the screenplay. And it's like, it's just a very sincere love story. Like, there's none of that high concept stuff. It's just about the connections between teenagers and the ways in which those connections can kind of change due to, like, the sort of everyday forces, internal and external, like, that young people face today. And, you know, it's a movie that sort of reminds you that high school romance is innocent, but it also comes with its own sorts of difficulties, and dealing with those difficulties is a huge part of the adolescent experience. But it's one that we don't necessarily always see when those romances are represented on screen, and you very much get that here. It's very, like I said, it's very basic. You've got Harper, played by Anjani Aksar. She's a teenager living in a suburb of Portland, Oregon, with her folks and her older brother, Adam, a kid named Alex Jarman. She just started high school, but things are going pretty well. She's got some friends. She's pretty happy. Still navigating the social landscape, but things are good. Then you've got Tilly, played by Quinn Liebling, who lives across the street. He's a year older than Harper. He and Adam have been best friends for years, and Harper's always kind of been the tag-along. But one day, circumstances lead to Tilly and Harper hanging out together without Adam, and they find themselves getting along extremely well. And so, in the incredibly fast manner of high school relationships, a story I'm sure you have seen play out a kajillion times, Harper and Tilly become an item. Their interests are divergent. She's a basketball player. He's in the school play, which, by the way, the school play that they're doing, As You Like It, there's a quote, The Thunderbolt in Mine Eye, which was the working title of this film. That's neither here nor there. But they, you know, they're drawn to each other. They spend more and more time together. But as they do that, they start to drift apart from their other friends and their social circles, and there's some conflict that comes from that. You know, the dissonance grows as the days pass. Her friends don't care for him and let her know. His friends, you know, are typical gross boys and say the sorts of things that typical gross boys say, and that makes Tilly insecure. And so that all starts to color the time that they spend together. You know, the relationship's just beginning to bloom, but the conflicts are threatening, and, you know, they're both sort of wondering what the right thing to do is. You know, do they stay together? Do they break up? And how does this impact their lives? Look, it's just, it works because of, again, because of how simple it is. It's this wonderful illustration of what it means to be a young person falling in love, and I'm not going to throw the scare quotes around love, because everything feels bigger when you're that age. And this movie does a great job of giving you that sense without actually sort of creating any of that sort of external largeness. Like, it's just very, very self-contained, very small, and very, very sweet. And it's just this, you know, it's just it's a look back at that time in all of our lives when everything, every little thing that happened was just earth-shattering. Like, every little word or deed is just packed with unspoken meaning, and anything that happens is the most important thing that has ever happened. And it's just, it's really wonderful. Like, just, it's all very awkward, and you have these, like, little cringy moments. Like, you know, like, just little things, like kids not knowing how to kiss because they've never kissed before. Like, things, like, just these little moments where it's just like, okay, you're clearly pulling very real memories from this. And, you know, it's got a very charming cast. The young actors who are in it, relatively inexperienced, but they all handle it very well. It all feels very real. Like, there's a wonderful verisimilitude to it because, again, it's not about anything other than itself. And by doing that, it's this wonderful sort of alternative to some of the more high concept sort of teen romances that we've been getting in recent years. Like, honestly, if you remember high school, or if you're still in high school, like, you're going to find a lot familiar about this story. So, yeah, I can't, like, young hearts, just a delight.
That sounds great. All right, we're talking with Alan Adams of The Main Edge. More movies for us. What's up next?
Well, you know, and as I spent that last talking about, you know, the unnecessary addition of outside factors for teen romances, we come to The Map of Tiny Perfect Things, which is currently streaming on Amazon Prime Video. And, yeah, it's a high school romance It's a time loop movie. Like it's exactly what I said these sorts of movies don't need in the previous review, and I still stand by that. They don't need them, but this one is actually kind of a lot of fun. Do we need another riff on the whole time loop trope? I don't know, but introducing it into with the framework of a high school love story gives it a little bit of distance from some of the more well-known entries into the genre. And the popularity of the genre is something that this film is very aware of, both in terms subtle and overt. Like there's some self-referential stuff that happens here that I think is a lot of fun. But like I said, I mean, this movie's not reinventing the wheel. Like the filmmakers have a very clear understanding of what makes these narratives work. They lean into the repetition and embrace the comedic possibilities of that. And again, maybe that limits the ceiling of the movie, but it also kind of assures that you've got a pretty high floor. And so you get this movie that's not great, but it's a pretty good viewing experience. So you got this high school kid named Mark, played by Kyle Allen, on what at first glance appears to be a pretty typical day. But from the moment he gets out of bed, it becomes clear that not all is what it seems. He knows everything that's going to happen before it happens, from his breakfast encounters with his dad and his younger sister, all the way through his a wonderful, actually, extended sequence where he makes his way to school in the morning. It's all, sort of following that set plan. And so that's when it's revealed, yes, turns out not Mark's first go at this particular day. He's in a time loop. We don't know how long he's been there. All we know is no matter what he does or how he spends his time, at exactly midnight, it all disappears, and he wakes up that morning and does it all again. You know, musing himself through various means, the standard sort of time loop shtick, like, you know, stealing heavy equipment and, you know, those that sort of thing, like bits, and it's fine, and it's funny. But it all changes when Margaret, played by Catherine Newton, shows up. Because as it turns out, Margaret is also in the time loop and finally has someone to share the experience. But she has her own motivations and her own ideas about how this whole infinite supply of time should be spent. And she's not being super forthcoming about her motivations. And then we get the sort of proposed solution to the dilemma, the titular map of tiny perfect things. And that's basically the two of them deciding that they're going to go around their town and basically plot out all of the small, wonderful moments that they've each sort of been able to experience over the course of, you know, reliving this day. Some of them are funny. Some of them are very poignant. You know, some of them are beautiful and touching. Some of them are ridiculous and crude. But it's all these little things and that they believe add up to a perfect day. But the truth is a little more complicated than that. And that truth can only come out if they're going to be honest with each other and with themselves. And again, I know I just said you don't need this stuff for this kind of romance. And honestly, I think in terms of just the purity of the romance, I think Young Hearts is probably a better movie. But this is really, I mean, it's really fun. Like, it doesn't try to do too much, sort of folds its central pairing into this, to the standard model. But there are some interesting choices that happen, and it's stylistically engaging. And, the two kids at the center, they have some good chemistry and it allows the narrative a little bit of stability. The supporting players are very solid. And yeah, like I said, an amiable enough take on the time loop trope. It's not going to make you forget the more ambitious examples within the genre. But as entertainment, it's got plenty of charm. It's a fun watch, and it doesn't pretend to be anything more than that.
There you go. All right, more movies. Alan had a busy weekend. What's next?
Okay, last love story. this one is called Little Fish. Directed by a guy named Chad Hartigan. The screenplay was written by Mattson Tomlin. And it's, I know we don't necessarily need these movies. It's a movie that takes place during a global pandemic, as they do. But this one, the pandemic is a disease that threatens memory. Basically, the deal is if you get this disease, a disease that they whose transmission they can't determine. They don't understand how it's transmitted. But if you contract this disease, you forget. whether it's immediately. Some people forget everything all at once. Some people forget in bits and pieces, but you're going to forget. And what this movie does is it takes that sort of big idea and reduces it down and just gives it to us through the prism of a single relationship. We have Emma, played by Olivia Cooke, and Jude, played by Jack O'Connell. She's sitting on the beach. He's walking his dog. She likes his dog. He likes her accent. Instant connection. And then they fall in love, and they get married, and everything inside is wonderful, even if the outside is scary. Like, this all happens during the early days of this pandemic. But more and more people keep forgetting, their friends, their families. And then Jude starts to forget. And Emma tries everything, tries to sign, even goes so far as trying to sign him up for these clinical trials, because the clock is ticking. And at some point, he is going to forget who she is. And all that life, all that love is just lost forever. And in an effort to mitigate the loss, you know, she's trying to remember everything herself. So throughout the movie, we're getting these flashbacks to the various moments in her relationship, from that initial sort of meet cute up through the present. And in those moments, we're given a sense of what this relationship is and what will be lost if it does disappear. So the world is crumbling, and they're forced to reckon with reality. They have to decide what they're willing to do and how far they're willing to go in search of an answer to this problem and to have any chance. Like, it's very possible that they're going to have to literally risk everything. Now, this is a very small movie, but the thoughts and feelings it evokes are anything but. Like, it's just so nice to watch a movie that is just wholly uncynical about love, about adult relationships. You know, it's a romantic journey by a flashback, even as we're watching the grief and anger that come when that love is taken away from us by whatever cruelties the universe throws at us. But in both instances, like, it's always treated, love is treated with respect. And so you have this, it's the whole flashback and forth kind of technique can kind of undermine a film's narrative flow sometimes, but Hartigan, the director, has a really solid handle on that balance. Like, he uses these memory scenes as expansions and punctuations both. So even as the tones diverge, that balance remains. Like, who we are is shaped by our past. And if our memories of that past are gone, then who even are we? And so you have that plus some wonderful flickers of dark humor that occasionally push through, as well as these brief moments of detail that illustrate the very fundamental changes to the world in which they live due to the circumstances of this pandemic. And you can really see why it clicks. And again, this needs to be stressed. The ending of this movie totally caught me by surprise and floored me. It is exceptional. I'm not going to tell you anything more than that, but the ending is outstanding. And it really just ties everything up into a bow that I wasn't ready for, and that really stung me. The performances are great. The central pairing, wonderful chemistry, great charisma. Like, they're fun to watch. It's just a smart, sincere movie that embraces the importance of memory and acknowledges its fleeting nature. Like, you know, forgetting what we've done and where we've been means forgetting who we are, both to others and to ourselves. And, you know, and it's just like that's a big lesson for a small movie to teach us. But it really does a wonderful job.
All right. And one last film to tell us about.
Yeah, last and certainly not least, because this might be the best of the bunch. I watched Judas and the Black Messiah, which is currently available on HBO Max. It's also available in theaters if that's your thing these days. I'm not going to tell you no, but just know you can watch it at your house if you have HBO Max. You know, it's interesting. How there have been, it feels like there have been a lot of movies in very recently, you know, sort of exploring this particular time in American history, that sort of late 60s, early 70s sort of countercultural civil rights, that sort of explosion of ideology that took place during that time. And so it's always interesting to see how different filmmakers and different people sort of address those stories and the sorts of things that they want to talk about. So Judas and the Black Messiah, it's directed by Shaka King from a screenplay that King co-wrote with Will Burson. And it's the story of the rise and fall and the tragic too soon death of Fred Hampton, who was chairman of the Illinois Black Panther Party in the late 1960s. One of really the most iconic black cultural figures of the 1960s. A guy feared by authorities, celebrated by the people, like super polarizing. You know, the establishment hated him, the counterculture loved him, and the powers that be just wanted him out of the picture. And so you have this story that is about anger, both righteous and fearful. Look at the revolutionary attitudes of that particular era writ large, thanks to the oratorical and rhetorical gifts of people like Fred Hampton, as well as the willingness of law enforcement to bend and even break laws they purport to serve in an effort to get rid of him. It's also the story of the man who sold Fred Hampton. It's challenging, it's provocative, and it's a movie that absolutely deserves every single iota of attention it is going to receive over the coming months of this weird awards season. So we're in the late 60s, Chicago, boiling over with racial unrest. The civil rights movement has seen a lot of its sort of icons lost to violence, and the notion of fighting back continues to grow more appealing. And that's the world in which Fred Hampton, played by Daniel Kaluuya, that's the world he moves in. Despite his age, he's very young. He's the chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, and through his speeches and just pure charisma, he's raising the profile of the plight of Black Americans, not just in his city but around the country. Those are the sorts of attitudes that put you in the crosshairs of mid 20th century federal law enforcement. As such, we meet Bill O'Neill, played by Lakeith Stanfield. He's a small time hoodlum, car thief who uses a fake badge to sort of gain access to whatever vehicle he's looking to steal. He gets busted, and when he does, he comes to the attention of the FBI, specifically a guy by the name of an agent by the name of Roy Maxwell, played by the wonderful Jesse Plemons, who makes Bill an offer: infiltrate the Black Panthers and get close to Fred Hampton, or you can go to prison. Like, that's the choice. And so Bill tries to make his way into the inner circle, which is not easy. Like, this is a guy who is surrounded by fiercely protective lieutenants, like true believers who are willing to do anything for him. But gradually, Bill manages to gain his trust. He slowly climbs the ladder, becomes more and more ingrained in Panther business, and the more ingrained he becomes, the more sympathy he starts to feel to the cause, even as he continues to deliver, you know, intel to, you know, he's informing on these people, even as he's sort of sympathizing with their play. So we watch as Fred Hampton and his close allies, I mean, folks like Jimmy Palmer, Jake Winters, Bobby Rush, and the woman who would become his lover and closest confidant, Deborah Johnson, played by just an absolutely outstanding performance from Dominique Fishback. She's wonderful here. They push their agenda forward. Like even when Fred Hampton goes to prison, like, everyone, including Bill O'Neill, is continuing the mission. But things come to a head when J. Edgar Hoover, played just, oh, he's so, like, it's Martin Sheen at his absolute grossest. Like, it's such, he's like, it's hard to call it good because he's just so unpleasant and off-putting, but it's a remarkable performance. He decides that the threat posed by Fred Hampton is too large to be handled through traditional means, and wants him removed in a more permanent fashion, which he is. This is the latest entry in that sort of rapidly growing subgenre of historical docudramas centered on this particularly tumultuous time. Like, we've seen a number of these, and we're talking about The Trial of Chicago 7, One Night in Miami, but this might be the most viscerally impactful, due largely to the frankness with which it sort of addresses the cultural and systemic issues. The black-white dynamic is much more fully displayed throughout. The big issue, if you want to call it that, I didn't have a huge problem with it, but I can understand how people might, is everybody in this movie is playing someone significantly younger than they are, because Fred Hampton was only 21 years old when he died, and Daniel Kaluuya is like 10 years older than that, you know. Fred O'Neill was like 17 when the FBI picked him up, and Lakeith Stanfield is significantly older than that. Again, I didn't have a huge problem with it, not least because it's tough to find, you know, it's going to be tough to find actors of that age that are going to be able to handle what this movie demands of those parts. Because here's the thing. You can have say whatever you want, have whatever issues you want with the veracity of the narrative and whatever. The performances in this movie are spectacular. Daniel Kaluuya is just mesmerizing. Like, he gets the cadences and the rhetorical passion, and just like watching the energy just flow when he's like speaking of revolution, like he's talking to the crowd. It's just amazing. Like, just white hot. Like, I mean, so powerful and so angry, and you just can't look away. Like, it's just a magnificent performance. And honestly, like, Lakeith Stanfield probably has the tougher role, because it's unbelievable to think, because you know, it's just such an utter and abject betrayal that O'Neill perpetrates on Fred Hampton, and yet we watch this movie and he manages to elicit a modicum of sympathy. Like, what he's doing is wrong. He knows it. We know it. But he also helps us recognize sort of the impossibility of the situation into which he's been placed. And so when he's sort of vacillating between what he wants to do and what he has to do, like, that conflict is right there for us to watch. The supporting cast, great, obviously. Like I said, I mentioned Dominique Fishback. She's outstanding. You know, she's probably the soul of the film. Plemons is great. I mentioned Sheen, who just really, I mean, just chewing on the scenery and leaning into like this sort of self-justified evil portrayal of J. Edgar Hoover. Those are highlights, but I mean, honestly, the entire set of the ensemble is just top-notch, all across the board. Like, so yeah, remarkable work of docudrama, a look back at a frankly not that long ago period in our history that doesn't necessarily receive the attention it warrants. Like, Fred Hampton's death was a tragedy, and that was long overlooked. And thanks to a movie like this, and particularly the just absolutely blazing performance that Daniel Kaluuya gives, you know, maybe it won't be overlooked anymore.
A lot of options out there for you. Alan Adams filling us in here on Pass the Popcorn. Thank you, Al.
Hey, my pleasure, man.
Nothing Wednesday this week. I will be out of the office, as we say, and so we'll check in with you again next Monday.
Yeah, we'll talk to you on Monday after you've put all these issues in the rear view.
Oh, thanks, Al.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye now.